government.
This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. The spokesperson for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said on Wednesday the leadership welcomes the recognition of a Palestinian state.
The recognition today of three important European countries is very important for the sake of peace, for the sake of seeking a two-state solution according to the international law. And we hope that the other European countries will follow, because this is the only way to achieve peace and stability in the world.
The spokesman made the comments outside the office in Ramallah in the Israeli-occupied West Bank after Ireland, Spain, and Norway announced they would recognize a Palestinian state on May 28th. The spokesman said they hoped other Western countries would follow suit. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said the move was aimed at accelerating efforts to secure a ceasefire in Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza. Spain and its allies have spent months lobbying European nations, including France, Portugal, Belgium, and Slovenia, to garner support for the recognition of a Palestinian state. Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz ordered the immediate return of the Israeli ambassadors to the three countries for consultations and warned of further severe consequences. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Wednesday the Biden administration remains concerned about Israel's possible use of heavy bombs against civilians in the southern Gaza city of Rafah and is in contact with Israel about it.
We've been very clear for a long time about our concerns about a full-scale military assault on Rafah, given the dense population there, and particularly the use of that kind of weapon in a dense urban environment.
Join VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises as we delve into the heart of the world's most pressing conflicts and crises, from the Israel-Hamas war to the Russian-Ukraine war. This is VOA News. A group representing the families of hostages held in Gaza have released new video footage showing Hamas's capture of five female Israeli soldiers near the Gaza border on October 7th. Here's AP correspondent Lisa Dwyer.
The video released by the Hostages Families Forum shows bloodied young women being taken. Ashley Waxman-Bakshi, whose cousin is in the video, describes her reaction.
I saw the video for the first time. I cried while watching it. And towards the end, I felt like I was going to throw up. I think any person who watches this video will understand that feeling, especially as a woman.
What? While watching the video was difficult, it still brought Bakshi some hope. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
The UN's World Food Program said on Wednesday that extreme weather attributed to the El Nino phenomenon is causing a surge in hunger in several countries, including Zambia and Afghanistan, and called on donors for much-needed help. The WFP warned southern Africa was the epicenter of the crises after a cycle of floods and drought has battered the region over the last 3 years, leaving millions impacted. El Nino is a natural, temporary, and occasional warming of part of the Pacific that shifts global weather patterns, and studies say climate change is making them stronger. Sites with radioactive material are more vulnerable to climate change as climate change increases wildfire and flood risk. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports.
The Department of Energy has recently required existing research labs, power plants, and weapon sites that handle or are already contaminated with radioactive materials to assess their vulnerability, citing 2021's deep freeze in Texas and wildfires at Los Alamos as examples. Paul Walker, a former staff member of the House Armed Services Committee, who now works for Green Cross International, says what might have been safe 25 years ago may no longer be safe. Officials with the National Nuclear Security Administration tell the AP they're convening a work group to develop methodology to address what might happen as a result of climate when assessing particular sites. Jennifer King, Washington.
Kenyan President William Ruto on Wednesday opened the first state visit to Washington by an African leader in more than 15 years as U.S. President Joe Biden seeks to counter geopolitical headwinds across the continent. Biden welcomed his Kenyan counterpart at the White House and then joined him in meeting business leaders ahead of Thursday's formal portion of the visit, which will start with an honor guard and culminate with a lavish state dinner. For this and all the stories we're covering, visit us at voanews.com. We also have an app you can download. Just search for VOA News. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Buckley, Washington. Today is Thursday, May 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are following. Kenyan President Ruto visited the White House Wednesday, the first day of his three-day state visit.
This visit of President Ruto symbolizes the strong connections that exist between Kenya and the United States and the strength and the depth of the relationship.
Liberia's health ministry establishes a national health sector task force. The ILO welcomed the Doha dialogue on mobility of migrant workers between Africa and Arab countries. Today is the International Day to End Obstetric Fistula. Chad's prime minister resigns.
This resignation is nothing extraordinary. It's based on the constitutional law that gives the prime minister the right to resignate when a new president is about to be elected as a new president.
And the plans of President Biden and former President Trump for the state of Pennsylvania in this year's presidential election. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President William Ruto visited the White House on Wednesday, the first day of his three-day state visit. Reuters quotes a source as saying that President Joe Biden is expected to designate Kenya as a major non-NATO ally during Ruto's visit. Johnny Carson served as United States Ambassador to several African countries, including Kenya. He tells me that Ruto's visit symbolizes the strong connection between the United States and Kenya.
This visit of President Ruto, the first state visit by an African leader under administration of President Biden, symbolizes the strong connections that exist between Kenya and the United States and the strength and the depth of the relationship. Kenya has been a strong partner and ally of the United States since its independence in 1963. It probably has the best relationship with Washington than any other state in East and Southern Africa.
Ambassador, I'm reading an article by Reuters saying that President Biden is expected to designate Kenya as a major non-NATO ally during a three-day state visit by Kenyan President William Ruto. If this comes through, this will be significant.
It will indeed. As I said before, Kenya has been America's strongest and most reliable partner in East Africa since its independence in 1963. That friendship and partnership has only grown stronger since 1991, when Kenya moved from a single-party state to a multi-party state. Since 1991, Kenya has had a succession of governments in which there have been changes of power, not only in state house, but amongst the political parties in the country. Sometimes those elections have been turbulent, but they've all successfully passed the baton from one leader to the other. No other country in East and Central Africa has had a better or stronger relationship more consistently than Kenya. Probably the only exception to that would be Botswana. But Kenya has been a partner. It has been a strong friend and has been supportive of the United States, and the United States has been supportive of Kenya.
Ambassador, some analysts have said that Ruto's visit is perhaps one way that the U.S. is trying to counter the inroads that Russia and China appear to be making in Africa.
The United States has its own interests in being in Africa, and those interests are not interests that are in competition with China in the sense that the U.S. is doing things only because China and Russia are. The U.S. has fundamental interests in being in Africa, and that's notwithstanding what the Russians and the Chinese do. The interests are longstanding, they're historical, they're political, they're economic, and they are longstanding. Long after other nations cease to be interested in Africa, the United States will be there.
Johnny Carlson is a former United States ambassador to several African countries, including Kenya. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. The vice president for political affairs and the diaspora of Chad's opposition Transformers Party says the party will continue to be a force in the politics for years to come. Dolembai Jesada's comment comes as Transformers leader Success Masra resigned on Wednesday as Chad's prime minister. His resignation followed the victory of interim president Mahamat Idriss Deby in the May 6 election. Jesada tells me that Masra's resigned in line with Chad's constitution.
This resignation is nothing extraordinary. It's based on the constitutional law that gives the prime minister the right to resignate when a new president is about to be invested as a new president, because we just finished the election. This is a new transition is over, as tomorrow the president Mahamat Idriss Deby, it will be his inauguration. So after his inauguration, he will definitely name either a new prime minister or keep the existing prime minister. But in order for him to do so, the sitting prime minister has to resign. This is just following the constitutional law. There is nothing extraordinary about this.
This resignation is coming at a time that the prime minister has some disagreement with the results of the election. Some may interpret the resignation as part of his continuing disagreement with the election.
You see, even if he agrees with the election, he still has to resign. That's the fact. So it really doesn't matter if he agrees or not. And in fact, if you listen to what he said, if the constitutional court imposed the result of this election to all of us, then we will need to look up into the future based on justice and equality for all. So regardless of the result of the election, the prime minister has to resign to allow the elect president to start his new mandate with his new team. That's just a normal protocol in political practices in our country.
Do you think he might consider, say, if President Deby reappoints him, do you think he might something he might accept?
I'm not sure if my thought is applicable here, but I believe Dr. Master succeeds a political man, and he knows where to make best choices for the future of the people of Chad and the country. This is beyond him and beyond the prime minister position, and I think the two of them will decide what to do next, because I'm the number two, but I'm not the decider.
Yeah, you're number two. What, so I guess his fit is tied to yours. What's the future of the party, the Transformer Party?
Oh, the Transformer Party is here for a long term. You know, we only have 6 years as a political party. But what we have done, no political party in China have done in the existence of this nation. So we still have the senatorial election coming up, the gubernatorial election coming up, the communal election coming up. So we will be participating in all these elections, because we need our members to be part of these government institutions. So, you know, some presidents, for example, in some countries have run 5-6 times before they get a chance to win. But we had a great chance, and this chance has been taken away from us. And it's known from the whole world that we are the undeniable democratic force in this nation. So we are not backing up. We're continuing, because this is our desire to see change happen in this country. And even President Mahamat Idriss Deby said that the people of Chad want change. Will change happen with the statute quo? That's the question. And that's up to what the next 5 years will tell us. But as far as the party is concerned, we are here for a long term and not for just this past election.
Dolembai Jesada is the vice president for political affairs and the diaspora of Chad's opposition Transformers Party. He was speaking with us from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. Liberia's Ministry of Health has established a National Health Sector Task Force. The announcement comes over a month after the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, revealed that 90% of pharmacies in Liberia are selling stolen medicine donated by aid organizations. Rita Jilobu Duo reports from Monrovia.
The task force includes the Liberia Medicines and Health Products Regulatory Authority, the Liberia Dental Council, the Liberia Pharmacy Board, the Ministry of Justice, the National Health Workers Union of Liberia, and the Chief Pharmacist of Liberia, among others. Health Minister Dr. Louis Boto outlines the directives of the group.
The mandate of this task force is to carry out a comprehensive assessment of the health sector, both public and private, to identify and document the challenges and bottlenecks that have been hindering the provision of quality health services to our citizens. With particular emphasis on the monitoring of the distribution and appropriate utilization of medicines and medical products provided by both donors and government to the public health care institutions.
However, some civil society organizations, or CSOs, say they were not consulted. Josh Klikpo is the Executive Director of Public Health Initiative Liberia, a member of the Civil Society Health Coalition of Liberia. She lauds the Ministry of Health for the initiative, but terms the absence of CSOs as a misstep.
We hope they can go back to the drawing board and know that civil society is a partner in this fight against corruption. The president himself has made a commitment to that from his inaugural speech. So his tone, he continues to stress the importance of his government working collaboratively with civil society. We believe that the ministry will have a rethink to ensure that civil society are around that table, because civil society are the eyes and ears and also mouths of the community. We amplify the issues that are happening in these facilities.
Early this month, the United Nations Joint Mission concluded its visit to Liberia and highlighted the urgent need for action to combat increasing maternal newborn deaths in the country. Dr. Anshu Banerjee, the mission's lead, emphasizes the gravity of the situation.
We have 1,100 women dying every year due to maternal mortality. For newborn deaths, we've seen that there is an increasing trend in newborn deaths in Liberia. That's very worrying. And the number of newborn deaths are 8,500. The other worrying trend that we've seen in Liberia is that the number of stillbirths are actually much higher than the newborn deaths. Underfed mortality overall, 22,500 children that are dying every year.
To improve the health situation in Liberia, Dr. Banerjee emphasizes that access to quality health care is a must.
There is a huge agenda around improving quality of care, improving access, improving skills, and ensuring that commodities and supplies are there.
The United States Agency for International Development, USAID, said in 2023 that it, along with Global Fund, donated $40 million worth of life-saving medicines and other health commodities to Liberia. But USAID's mission director, Jim Wright, expressed frustration that a donated medicine often does not reach Liberians who badly need them due to fraud and mismanagement. For VOA Daybreak Africa, I am Rita Jawiduo in Monrovia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 23rd. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The International Labour Organization, ILO, has welcomed the Doha Dialogue on Mobility of Migrant Workers between Africa and Arab countries. ILO Regional Director for Arab States, Ruba Yarada, discussed how to effectively govern the mobility of migrant workers between African and Arab countries at the Africa Gulf Cooperation Council, Jordan and Lebanon Dialogue on Labour Mobility in Doha. Political analyst David Monda tells VOA's Douglas Mpoga that this meeting could not have come at a better time.
I think this is a very important meeting because we know that migration and the questions of international labor, they go beyond individual countries. This is a global problem that has to be dealt with in a multi-sector, in a multilateral framework. So I definitely welcome the ILO intervention and also this initiative in Qatar that is really looking to change the narrative around, you know, workers' rights and labor rights between Africa and the Middle East.
People have pointed out the fraudulent and abusive recruitment practices, such as the payment of recruitment fees and related costs by workers to some contractors on the continent. How serious is that issue?
I think that's a very serious issue. We've seen in many countries where unscrupulous recruitment agencies take advantage of migrants to abuse them. And also when they go to some of these Middle Eastern countries, their rights as migrants, as workers are denied. Their passports are taken away, their ability to travel, their rights, their human rights are actually abused. So this is definitely a problem. But I must also add that this meeting couldn't have come at a better time because many countries do not have clear policy in terms of migrant labor. The recent case in Malawi where we had the Malawian women, Kenyan women, Ugandan women going out to the Gulf and ending up in commercial sex work, in prostitution, a lot of them dying. So this is definitely a huge problem. And I think then in conclusion, you know, we also need to think about the Fair Recruitment Initiative Advisory Committee, which is also a very important element of this meeting. It includes Tunisia, Mexico, and Kenya. And the idea behind this initiative is to come up with some kind of resolution around fair recruitment. So the country of origin and the host country come together to establish some very basic tenets, some very basic guidelines in terms of recruitment, in terms of recruitment skills, social protection, and skills development for these workers. So this initiative could not have come at a better time. This is a huge problem. Africa has the labor. The Middle East needs that labor. I think finding a middle ground which would be beneficial for both continents, but also safe for the workers.
David Monda is a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with viewers Douglas Mpuga from New York. Pennsylvania is one of a handful of U.S. states that could determine the outcome of November's presidential election. VOA correspondent Scott Stern looks at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump are doing to win there.
Pennsylvania is a large, politically divided state that could go either way in this election. Michael Sansis teaches political science at Pennsylvania's Temple University.
We went for Donald Trump in 2016. We went for Joe Biden in 2020. And at both times, there's a difference of, you know, 40,000 votes or 80,000 votes in a state of, you know, millions of people. So we're closely divided.
Sansis says Pennsylvania voters' top concerns in this election are the economy and immigration.
There's a lot of talk among Biden's folks trying to highlight the positives in the economy. This still doesn't seem to have really caught on with the general public. So they're still very concerned about the economy. People are concerned about immigration and the southern border, even though Pennsylvania is nowhere near the southern border.
Trump campaigning in Pennsylvania includes attacking Biden border policies and clean energy initiatives.
To think about what we have to go through and the things we put up with the border, with no energy independence, with all electric cars. Would everybody like to buy an electric car for the rest of your life?
Electric vehicles and Chinese imports are sensitive issues in a state where union voters are politically active and organized. Biden this month quadrupled import duties on Chinese electric vehicles, saying unfair competition is cheating U.S. workers.
I'm determined that the future of electric vehicles will be made in America by union workers, period.
Trump told Pennsylvania gun owners that Biden lacks the character to serve another 4 years.
Joe Biden is the worst and most incompetent and most corrupt president in the history of our country.
Biden grew up in the Pennsylvania city of Scranton and campaigns on those local working class roots, portraying Trump as someone who he says, quote, bows down to billionaires.
We all know guys like that growing up. My vision of America is one of hope and opportunity. The view from Scranton, working class Americans like you.
Biden running mate and Vice President Kamala Harris campaigned in Pennsylvania this week, her fourth visit this year.
We believe in the promise of America, a promise of freedom, equity, opportunity, and justice, not just for some, but for all.
She said Pennsylvania voters should not be misled by Trump and his allies.
In this moment, extremists are trying to divide our nation. And we see them as they encourage xenophobia and hate.
Trump told Pennsylvanians that he'll regain America's standing.
We will restore American strength at home. We were respected 4 years ago all over the world. Today, we are considered a joke. It's not going to be for long.
Political polling by the Philadelphia Inquirer this month shows Biden and Trump in a statistical tie in Pennsylvania, with lower support for Biden among both young and non-white voters compared to 4 years ago. Both of those groups were central to Biden winning the state in 2020. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Over 2 million girls and women are living with untreated fistulas globally. This is according to the World Health Organization, which says that there are more than 100,000 new cases of the condition affecting women around the world each year. And as the world marks International Day to End Obstetric Fistula today, Thursday, the WHO says pregnant women who experience prolonged or obstructed labor and are at risk to develop the problem. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
Obstetric fistula is caused by obstructed labor that accounts for up to 6% of all maternal deaths globally. The condition occurs when a hole develops between the birth canal and bladder or rectum during childbirth, resulting in constant urinary or fecal leakage. According to the United Nations Population Fund, at least 23 countries around the globe have developed national fistula strategy as one way to end the condition. Bridget Asiama, who is the technical specialist at UNFPA, says easy accessibility to fistula treatment is key to preventing and managing the illness.
The theme for this day, 2024 International Day to End Fistula, is breaking the cycle. Preventing fistula worldwide. It's a call to end the condition by preventing its occurrence in the first place, which will consequently break the harmful cycle of ill health, intergenerational poverty, and social marginalization.
In sub-Saharan Africa, more than 50,000 women giving birth annually develop obstetric fistula. Sharon Korir is a fistula warrior and founder of Save a Woman Fistula Foundation in Kenya. She developed the condition after childbirth.
Our baby came out so forcefully, tore my vagina all the way to the rectum. So instead of having two organs, I had one organ. Fistula is a very devastating condition. It's a demonizing condition that women get, especially in Kenya, in Africa, because of the healthcare providers.
The fistula injury often leads to social stigma and exclusion among the affected women. The condition also causes skin infections and kidney disorders. Korir says countries should create awareness about fistula as many healthcare facilities lack proper care of the injury.
As we mark this day also, I just want to appeal again to well-wishers to kindly support causes in whichever country that they're in that are dealing with women with fistula the way, any way they can. The reality is 1 in 100 women has fistula. So that's how rampant it is in Africa. And the more we are silent about it, the more we don't support such women.
UNFPA says 90% of pregnancies in which women develop fistula result in stillbirths.
The journey of a fistula patient is challenging. Yet woven within this narrative are threats of resilience, courage, and hope. Support for every woman and girl who goes through this journey should be holistic, tailored to enhance her quality of life, agency and dignity, and contribution to her community. At UNFPA, we are unwavering in our commitment to lead the global campaign to end fistula and ending preventable maternal deaths and morbidities, which is one of our three transformative goals.
The WHO says health systems and communities are falling short in ending obstetric fistula. USAID Reproductive Health Senior Advisor Erin Miyoki says the agency has been in the forefront of ensuring fistula is addressed and women's dignity restored.
Since 2005, USAID has supported efforts to prevent and treat fistula in low-resource settings around the world.
The organization says adolescents' pregnancy, obstructed labor, lack of access to health facilities and midwifery care, and maternal malnutrition are some of the causes of the condition. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
And that's it for this Thursday, May 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Bucky, Washington, saying, have a great day and please be safe whatever you do.